Welcome to an all-new episode of the Future Podcast. I'm Steve Factor, and let's talk about Friends. It turns out the TV show Friends was even more preposterous than suspected by New Yorkers, real estate agents, psychiatrists. You know, they did a study that said most Americans can't scrape together $500 in case of an emergency. Well, guess what? A new study shows that most Americans can't rub three friends together in an emergency, much less five in a luxury apartment without rats the size of dachshunds. So in 2004, there was a study that said that the average American was satisfied with how many close friends they had. They had nine on average. But there was a recent Gallup study that showed that number has plummeted substantially. So what changed? Let's talk about why this is happening, or at least my hypothesis on why it's happening, and what we might be able to do about this crazy, insane social trend that's really going to create a lot of problems, already is creating a lot of problems for society. In 1990, only 3% of people said that they had no close friends. Today, that number is up 400%. 12% of people say they have no one to turn to at all. It was all bad news except for one thing. How many people claim to have 10 or more close friends? That dropped from 33% in 1990 to about 13% today. Good. No one has that many close friends besides Santa and Putin. Santa because he's dropping gifts on you and Putin because he's dropping poison in your soup. And also, I think there might be some definitional issues about what is a close friend. I think that definition varies by person. There's a spectrum. So here's my spectrum. At the very basic level, it has to be someone who calls you on your birthday, not someone who just, you know, can barely be bothered on Facebook to write HBD. And the next level up is someone who'll drive you to the airport or someone who'll help you move. And I don't care if they have a hernia or they're very dainty and have weak wrists. The very least they can do is just wrap stuff up in newspaper, if there is such a thing as newspaper anymore. The next level from there is someone who lets you crash in their home for a month, no matter how many dirty looks they get from their spouse. And then, of course, the next level is someone who lends you $2,000. Now, $2,000 is a lot of money for some, not a lot for others, but I think it's enough to establish that that person means something to you. And finally, the best kind of friend is someone who will help you hide a body. I'm not saying how you ended up with a dead body, but someone who doesn't ask a lot of questions and really just helps out when you need them most. And also hopefully is good with stains. Or can Google, not Google, use one of those secure search engines to find a really good stain remover. But that's a friend. Anything less than that is not a friend. It's a Pokemon. And that's basically what your Facebook friends are. They're just digital avatars. You're not going to see more than 2% of them in real life ever again. They might have passed away months or years ago, but you've accumulated them and now it makes you feel good because you see that number and it's like, wow, look at all these people who are not going to let me stay in their house or bury somebody with me. All right, let's carry on. According to the study, things are even worse among men. Today, 15% say that they have no close friends at all. And both sexes have had huge declines. So half of both men and women said they have three or fewer close friends. I also started thinking about my own male friendships and how different they are from the women I know. Guys just don't bond in those ways. I would bet that men just generally are incapable of having that deep or that close a relationship. You see guys, the way they hug, you know, like they can't get out of there fast enough. It's like, oh, you know, this goes gay in another half a second. There is this other side of the spectrum with guys who are maybe more feminine or feminized or even gay. And they're more capable of having that same kind of like emotional bond as women do. I think because of that, over time, those relationships tend to drift apart much more easily because you never achieved that closeness in the first place. You know, I have friends that are into tech or we do outdoor stuff or we travel or we do this or that. Like they're very task-oriented friendships, but very few that I could think of could I call and confide in about problems in a relationship. When I was having problems in a relationship, I looked at my phone and not a single name popped out, you know, not a male friend. I find that women are much more able to listen and engage on that level. And I don't know that we should seek to make men more like women in that way. At some point, you still want to retain a little bit of that stoicism where you still do the things that, quite frankly, society expects of you and that you need to do in order to survive, which is, you know, be a provider. Very few guys can opt out of the provider model. And I guess in that respect, you know, that doesn't lend itself to a lot of emotional outpourings. Like, this is as close as I'm going to get to anything emotional over the course of this week, probably. But it's something to think about. In The Economics of Happiness, I wrote, happiness is the last thing left to innovate. Well, we've got a lot of innovating to do because friendships predict life satisfaction. And we're sliding towards a very serious happiness epidemic. And not a bat, nor a pangolin, nor a Fauci can help with this pandemic. So why is this happening? I came up with four big reasons. I'm sure there are others. And these apply to the US, but I suspect that a lot of Western economies are experiencing a lot of these same trends. So the first thing is aging. And the problem there is not exactly what you'd think. A lot of it has to do with what youth is and what adulthood is not. Youth is a time of discovery and captivity. You're basically a prisoner where you're shepherded from school to sports to parties to camps, summer, not labor, with hordes of other kids your age who you make friends with, you discover music, you discover sex, you discover your parents' pot or their porn stash. Actually, they don't have that anymore. You're going to have to fish with their hard drive and a lot of encryption. You're going to have to learn encryption, basically. But in the old days. But as we age, everything about us freezes in time. All of us settle, for some reason, on Elton John and a short list of favorite fritters that we order at the restaurant, or a haircut from our glory days. For the longest time, I had a goatee. I had to, you know, fight my own worst instincts to shave that stupid thing off. And we also settle into a handful of these comfy relationships. Discovery ends. We become our parents. Now imagine if this happened to an entire country, because it did. In 1980, the median age of an American was 30, still young enough to get past a bouncer at the club. Today, that median age is pushing 40 and being dragged out of Studio 54 for looking 44. Then you're on your car ride home, back to the suburbs, listening to Tiny Dancer. Hopefully by then the bleeding has subsided and started to crust up nicely. And you start to realize our days of discovery are over. Barring any kind of extraordinary intervention, like lip fillers. How much do lip fillers actually help you look younger? I need a study on that. Since it's also fashionable now to break everything down by race, who am I to be unfashionable? So let's talk about that for a second. I found this chart from 2014. So if you have something a little bit more recent, send it to me. Basically, white people so old, so old. The median white, aka vanilla, was over 43 years old. That's practically eating steak out of a blender. And other races are also starting to inch upward. Asians are the only ones close to 35, but everyone else is under 35. All of this makes me think of my dad, who I am told is white, even though we're immigrants from the Soviet Union and I grew up stomping cockroaches in our crappy apartment in a shitty neighborhood. But okay, let's just go with that. But, you know, he's a reasonably healthy guy. He's 81 years old. He's a former engineer. He's, you know, up on current events. He can work the internet and Android and WhatsApp at basically the speed of global warming. And he's also got like three Kindles for, I don't know for what reason, I don't know how you read three Kindles, but somehow he also has a Groupon for unlimited tech support for me. I don't remember selling this Groupon, but they apparently bought it. And yet this learned man who has so much going for him and so many gadgets no friends. Where's he going to meet them? On Fox News Friend Finder? I mean, that's actually not a terrible idea. Maybe they could call it like Silver Foxes or Antiqua. That looks much better in writing. And it's kind of sad that he doesn't have access to male camaraderie or intimacy or an outlet to complain about my mom, who, by the way, has many outlets. She has friends, and man, do they get an earful. Whether it's the macro or the micro, it's hard not to realize why we have all these political tensions and all this insecurity in the country. It comes with seeing your best days and your best relationships enter the rearview mirror. And that's exactly what's happening. So then when you zoom in, you see the next reason why this is happening. We have a sinking birth rate. It is plummeting. It's plummeting all across the West, but in the US especially. Now births are well below replacement, below 2.1, which is replacement rate. Child-free adults, we convince ourselves that we're going to conquer industry. We're going to become Thelma and Louise and live out every wild, carefree fantasy. Nope. We settle. Boy, do we settle. In houses, with dogs, and Hondas. Not one car chase or gunfight to our name. This isn't even Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants or the Traveling Wilburys. This is the suburban, stagnant, sitting Wilburys. This is suburbia. And suburbia demands kids. The entire business model for most of how America lives is kids. And that's the business model for 40-somethings. But kids aren't just something useful that can theoretically take care of you in your old age. But kids are the final friend discovery mechanism for adults. So long after schools and bars and clubs have kicked you out or you're far too hideous to go in and meet anyone in real life and all the parties are over, there's kids. And schooling and activities and all these other obligations become ways of meeting and bonding with other people who share a common purpose with you, keeping them off the pole and off the dole. Even socially, without having kids as that binder, middle-aged couples, divorcees, and singles, put them in one room and they have all the chemistry of a tent city under a bridge in LA. You need that binding ingredient, and kids are that. After that, what's left? The dog park? Look, Fido's poop is pretty magical, but it's hardly the stuff that great friendships are made of. The third reason that friendships are declining, in my view, is this pilgrimage to cities. In The Economics of Happiness, I wrote this. Let me read you this section. It's called Crowded But Alone. No culture exalts individuality, independence, and hero worship like the US. That approach has created some revolutionary entrepreneurs and iconic achievements. But these days, even when our heroes collaborate, they produce something more like the Avengers, a collective of self-absorbed assholes who prefer to do their own thing in their own way for their own reasons. Now imagine more people than ever being able to trade in their we for me. That's exactly what's happening. We are on our own, alone. By choice. Men and women started earning enough money to stay single longer. Pets and roommates replace spouses. And those who do marry, they divorce more often, despite the fact that there's evidence married people live longer. Birth rates in the West plummeted as it became cheaper to buy a yacht than to raise a child. Many Americans would rather kickstart a stranger's company than pay for diapers and daycare. Plus, old age just isn't as scary in a world where meat arrives on styrofoam instead of its own four legs. Long child-free lives shift the burden of happiness from family and community to career and maybe the occasional trip to Jamaica. But most of our eggs sit in the work basket, hoping they hatch happiness if we sit on them long enough. I don't think you can sit on those eggs long enough to replace what we've lost. But you can't really talk about the rise of lonesome cities and their hordes of Tinder zombies and office drones without discussing the hollowing out of small towns and suburbs. When blue-collar work started to go away, so did the youth. They had to find opportunities. And when they departed, it left these aging husks of loosely employable people who were invisible to the information economy. Too old to retrain, you know, and you're going to teach, you know, some old dude who was a pipe fitter to code. And they're also tethered to these depreciated homes that are almost paid off. So they're not going anywhere. And some are addicted to prescription pacifiers or meth. Great friendships rarely spawn from decay. And there's a lot of decay. And the youth who left weren't much happier for it. A different survey showed that 22% of millennials say they have no friends. Trading family and community for tiny cubicles, and tiny apartments, and a tiny sprinkle of polyamory seems like a Faustian bargain. In case you don't know what that is, a Faustian bargain is a deal you make with the devil to get what you think you want, but ultimately get burned by it. Ooh, burned by the devil. Someone should write a song about that. Wait, wasn't there a Motley Crue song called, that was Shout at the Devil? All right, burned by the devil. That's, maybe if they make a comeback. That brings me to the fourth thing, which is capsizing of community. When I first started thinking about this whole subject and I was taking notes into my phone, I started looking at this dumb phone and I'm like, you little stupid time thief. And then I looked at these avatars on my speed dial and I'm like, will any one of these people show up to clear my search history if I suddenly die watching the Victoria's Secret runway show? I doubt it. By the way, that's a quick sneak peek of next week's episode on Victoria's Secret, which is amazing. But this trend, it's not just because of phones or social media. There's a book called Bowling Alone, published in 2000 by Robert Putnam. And he goes through tons of data that shows how we're becoming disconnected from friends and family and neighbors and community. And it's just becoming more noticeable now. And I think what happened was something similar like the pandemic. So the pandemic, it accelerated a lot of trends that we were already seeing. Everything from remote work to remote healthcare, online delivery of all our stuff, mobile payments. Social media did the same exact thing. It did the same thing to community and relationships. It just accelerated what was already happening and made it more blatant. And you're suddenly seeing it in all the statistics. As we branch out into these virtual communities, we're finding them to be fleeting and cold and lonely. And the reason for that is these bonds, these new bonds, are weak. They're held together by interest, not by mutual necessity. It's like, hey, I love sushi. You love sushi too. Well, let's go out to sushi. If that person gets hit by a truck tomorrow, I guarantee you, you're going to find someone else who loves sushi just as much. But in the past, it's like, hey, let's go fix Bob's roof because lightning just hit it. Or whatever else, you know, you go protect the village. And don't get me wrong, those times were pretty crappy in other ways. I'm not romanticizing everything. But the bonds were important. The bonds were ones of necessity. But these new flimsy digital relationships, it's like getting full on M&Ms. You're physically full, but you're still malnourished. And it's sort of this placebo effect because you're like, hey, look at all my friends. And in the end, how human are they? This thing robs us of our humanity. Tech just jumped way ahead of our biology and psychology and our economic structures and our culture. We're having trouble adjusting, and maybe we never will. And maybe we even triggered some sort of weird new Darwinism or extinction event where only Kardashians and TikTokers survive because they're genetically optimized for followers and not friends. In the meantime, deep down, we're still tribal. This need for community stays inside of us and it's innate, but it's increasingly out of reach. We don't rely on communities for physical survival anymore. Much of that has been outsourced to government and industry. Social security, sanitation, police, 401ks. Americans move out of the house by 18 or run away by 12. But we still crave community. Ever wonder why there's a Chinatown in every major city on Earth? Even more in China? We crave the company of others that are like us. Tribes were always built on need and commonality, finding, defending, or capturing scarce resources, or some irrational love or hate for someone or something, real or imagined. With need gone, We cling to the irrational to glue our shoddy tribes together. And that's what's happening. We're seeing it all around us. You know, when necessity goes away, we become more tribal because all that's left is hating something or loving something, whether it's Trump or whatever it is, it starts to turn into a religion. Is this bad? What if we could use more alone time with Minecraft? And maybe the digital world works fine for a lot of other people. And if you're still here with me, you chose to spend this time with a virtual stranger instead of speaking to a coworker or calling a sick friend. I might not even be real. I might be a deep fake or a bot that's just tossing around word salad and maybe tossing some other salads as well. Well, all the evidence shows that this is not working. As friendship declines, depression, drug use, suicide, shootings, all these mental health indicators, everything is flashing red. Only so many of these can be blamed on Tucker Carlson or Karl Marx. People are breaking down. We're focusing on the wrong things. We're withering in isolation. And a lot of it is self-imposed. But there is hope. Without realizing it, I've kind of been writing about all the forces that brought us to this loneliness for over a decade. In 2010, I wrote a thing called Profiting from the Death of Masculinity. And since then, there's a lot of deaths that I've mourned. Analog happiness, tolerance, truth, and the American dream. So what were predictions at the time are now chapters in America's biography. They're chronicling the rise of people like Jordan Peterson and really just the entire category of self-help and therapy and wellness and self-medication. I can see why everyone's on CBD oil or trying to get access to pot. Life is hard and there's a lot of forces that are creating this anxiety that's fundamentally incompatible with how we're wired. So what's next? Look, I'm not going to pretend I have all the answers, but I feel like I'm in a good place to share some of my ideas, and they're really clues as to what can solve this loneliness epidemic. And at some point, I'll expand on these in future episodes, and you'll see some of these recurring themes, but I've put these into buckets, basically three categories: stopping, starting, and hoping. Let's talk about the first one, stopping. Our days are filled with a bunch of activities that drive isolation. And I truly believe that people who can resist porn, social media, and other digital temptations are going to have an evolutionary advantage. They're going to unlock countless hours to engage with others in meat space. And no, meat space is not my new porn site. That's just my shorthand for the real world. And who better to take this advice from than the people who built our addictions? Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and a lot of these Silicon Valley titans, they don't let their kids anywhere near their own monstrosities. Their kids build go-karts, they knit, they cook, and calculate their inheritances on an abacus. On an abacus, nothing digital. And they make them extra heavy so the kids get a workout. This is no accident. They know how addictive these things are, how destructive they can be. Drugs, poor nutrition, lack of sleep, gaming, overconsumption of entertainment, and overstimulation are all the things I did before recording this. Those are all things we're doing, and we better stop, because the sooner we do, the more capacity we unlock for healthy activities. So what are those? Let's talk about the next category, starting. What are the things we need to start doing? In 2019, I wrote this in one of my blog posts. Life is servitude to our obligations. All contentment depends on it. Obligations we choose bring satisfaction and joy. Ones imposed or mandated by circumstances feel oppressive. I think that's the key to life and to reconnecting with others, ruthlessly seizing control of our obligations. And what are obligations? They're implicit and explicit promises that we make to our children, to our partners, and others we care about. And in this world that doesn't need us anymore, we have to make ourselves needed. We have to simulate all the necessity that modern life took away from us. And for most people, that means having a family. And I don't mean this in any kind of preachy way. And I know this doesn't sound especially hip or enlightened, but family always was and will continue to be the glue of every successful society. And it's also something that tethers us to reality in a way nothing else can, not friendships and definitely not work. Comedian Tim Dillon said it best, quote, "Very few people are going to have a career that fulfills them on a level where they don't have to have kids. I have friends who are perfectly happy without kids. They're constantly finding new adventures, new businesses, they're traveling, and they're satisfied with their lives, their relationships. But there are a bunch of others, way more, who are desperately low on Netflix series to binge and out of new booties to buy their cats. Now, whether this was a conscious choice or cruel circumstance, this is a ship that always sails. And take this from a guy who's watching his leave harbor right now. Almost as important is defining our values and living by our principles. It's getting harder and harder. Faith is declining. And not to say that faith was the be-all and end-all, but the problem is we haven't built another vessel to deliver values to people. And if we did have this vessel, it would be built by China and piloted by Captain John Cena and his crew of Uyghur slaves. That's the reality. We don't have this means of communicating or even developing what are our principles. There are a lot of people who I think are doing good out there, but actually are deeply unprincipled. And it's destabilizing the country and probably the world. Now, there are workarounds. People who have stable finances and a useful skill will find meaning in helping others who need their help. Like for a long time, I taught junior achievement, which is great. It's you go into high school classes and you teach them about success skills, or you help them run a company and show them how to make profit and do all the different functions. It was great. It was a great learning experience, great for the kids, mostly inner city kids. And just like that research that shows that faking a smile eventually makes you happier, same thing here. Even if you haven't found those values, those principles, that purpose, just volunteering to help others, it's the greatest form of self-help because it helps you make those connections and those bonds that lead to discovery, that lead to meaning, because you do enough meaningful things and eventually they add up to purpose. And there are these new family on-demand services. There's one called Papa that helps match young people to lonely retirees to steal their money. No, I'm kidding. It's perfectly above board, but it's almost too perfectly engineered. You'd think this thing would perfectly solve the loneliness dilemma, but I don't know if there's enough motivation, especially on young people's side, in order to do it. And I hope they're successful because I think it can really help society. And a while back, I also speculated that daily exercise, healthy diet, and a puppy could replace anywhere between 70 and 90% of America's addiction to therapy and antidepressants. Look at this chart. Tell me that we are not being milked for profit. This is the only country this addicted to antidepressants. It's insane. We're not that different from all of these developed countries, and yet we are way, way overdrugged. And I think there's a better way, and a lot of it is going to require willpower, and that's hard to develop. It's been a struggle for me. And, you know, it's funny because I'm a first-time dog owner. And I got to tell you, there's nothing like a puppy's bowel movements to force you out of the house, because the alternative is you don't want to deal with that. It forces you to engage with the world. And the cuter your dog, or the sadder your dog's story, or the more heroic. It's like, yeah, I ran into this building. It was on fire. My jacket was burning, but I knew I had to grab as many puppies as I could. Anyway, don't lie. But you're going to make friends, or you're slowly going to descend into this embarrassing baby talk with this furry ignoramus who can't understand a thing. Oh, cutie little plutie, which is what I call my dog. Anyway, the last category, the third category, is hoping. There are a lot of things that impact our lives: economics, politics, technology, culture. Now, these effects are secondary. They're powerful, but they're secondary. And I put them in the hope bucket because many of them are well beyond our control. At best, we would benefit just by understanding them and understanding what's happening so we could make adjustments in our personal lives. But changing them requires years of dedication, organization, toil, commitment, and still no guarantees of progress. Like, look at the gay rights movement. That started, you know, in full force, like in the 50s, and they went bottom up trying to change legislation, trying to gain acceptance, trying to gain equality in the laws, trying to get marriage accepted. And then everything, you know, like all of those dominoes fell almost instantly. So it looked instantaneous, like, you know, everyone suddenly changed. But it took years and years, decades of organization. And most people will not be satisfied with that slow progress. And that's what you're seeing now, because all these people are, you know, tweeting all day about all of these huge issues, but your ability to affect them is so small and change is so slow that they're destined to be unsatisfied. And I'm not saying not to fight for grand visions or, you know, that these things aren't important. They are. And you could probably meet a lot of great people who share your passions. But if we're solving for friendship, the people around us, even if we can help them in small but tangible ways, packs way more bang for the buck. Anyway, that's it for this episode. I'm Steve Factor. If you enjoyed this, a lot of work goes into it. Please support the show. It's patreon.com/McFuture. You'll get exclusive first looks at future episodes. The next one is going up shortly, and you'll get a bunch of exclusives. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it. Share it with others. I will see you next time on the McFuture. So, what's next?
People. 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 Are the luckiest people in the world. We're children. Needing other children.
All right, I guess this is where I admit that this was all an elaborate ploy to get you to listen to Barbara Streisand's People. And by the way, she is one bad bitch. You gotta love Barbara Streisand. First of all, she popped a cap in that extra A in Barbara. She didn't go Barbara, it's Barbara. And that takes balls. That woman is fierce.